हरिब्रह्मेन्द्र समर्चिता हर्यक्ष वाहना हंस वाहना तदा नमा हत्यादि पाप शमनी हरिदश्वादि सेविता हस्ति कुंभोत्तुंग कुचा हस्ति कृत्ति प्रियांगना हरिद्रा कुंकुमादिद्धा हर्यस्वाद्यमरार्चिता हरिकेश सखी हादि विद्या हाला मदालसा सकार रूपा सर्वज्ञा सर्वेशी सर्वमंगला सर्वकर्त्री सर्वभर्त्री सर्वहंत्री सनातनी सर्वानवज्ञा सर्वांग सुंदरी सर्वसाक्षिणी सर्वात्मिका सर्वसौख्यदात्री सर्वविमोहिनी सर्वाधारा सर्वगता सर्वावगुणवर्जिता सर्वारुणा सर्वमाता सर्वभूषणभूषिता ककारार्था कालहंत्री कामेशी कामितार्थदा कामसंजीविनी कल्या कठिनस्तनमंडला करभोरुः कलानाथमुखी कचजिताम्बुदा कटाक्षस्यन्दि करुणा कपालि प्राणनायिका कारुण्य विग्रहा कांता कांतिभूत जपावलिः कलालापा कंपुकंठी करनिर्जित पल्लवा कल्पवल्ली समभुजा कस्तूरी तिलकांचिता हकारार्था हंसगतिर्भाटकाभरणोज्ज्वला हारहारि कुचा भोगा हाकिनी हल्यवर्जिता हरिपति समाराध्या हठात्कार हतासुरा हर्षप्रदा हविर्भोक्त्री हार्दसंतमसापहा हल्लीसलास्य संतुष्टा हंसमंत्रार्थरूपिणी हानोपादान निर्मुक्ता हर्षिणी हरिसोदरी हा हा हू हू मुखस्तुत्या हानिवृद्धि विवर्जिता हय्यंग वीन हृदया हरिगोपारुणांशुका लकाराख्या लता पूज्या लयस्थित्युद्भवेश्वरी लास्य दर्शन संतुष्टा लाभा लाभ विवर्जिता लंघेतरा ज्ञानावण्यशालिनी लघुसिद्धिदा लाक्षारस सवर्णाभा लक्ष्मणाग्रज पूजिता लभ्येतरा लब्ध भक्ति सुलभालांगलायुधा लग्नचामरहस्तश्री शारदा परिवीजिता लज्जापद समाराध्या लंपटालकुलेश्वरी लब्धमाना लब्धरसा लब्धसंपत्समुन्नतिः ह्रींकारिणी ह्रींकाराध्या ह्रीं मध्या ह्रीं शिखामणिः ह्रींकारकुण्डाग्निशिखा ह्रींकारशशिचन्द्रिका ह्रींकारभास्कररुचिर्ह्रींकाराम्भोदचञ्चला ह्रींकारकन्दाकुरिका ह्रींकारैकपरायणा ह्रींकारदीर्घिका हंसी ह्रींकारोद्यानकेकिनी ह्रींकारारण्यहरिणी ह्रींकारावालवल्लरी ह्रींकारपञ्जरशुकी ह्रींकाराङ्गणदीपिका ह्रींकारकन्दरासिंही ह्रींकाराम्भोजभृङ्गिका
Hello. Welcome. It's very, very beautiful to be here with you this afternoon, tonight, in the midst of the celebration of Diwali, which is one of the auspicious festival days in India and now celebrated all over the world. So let's begin by invoking the spirit of Diwali, and then we'll segue into what will be our topic for the next 3 weeks, that is the Shakti of Lalita Tripura Sundari, who is known as the one whose form is solidified bliss, which is one reason why this is such a particularly auspicious day for beginning this process together. So, first of all, Diwali. Diwali, or Deepavali, which literally means the celebration of light, and it's the culmination of a 5-day festival that includes many, many rituals, bathing ceremonies, cleaning your house, putting up huge boxes of sweets which you share with your family and neighbors. It's sometimes part of a celebration of a day when Krishna defeated a demon. In other parts of India, it's celebrated as the day that Vishnu sent a demon king named Bali into the underworld. In some parts of India, it celebrates the goddess Lakshmi. In other parts, Kali. In other parts, Durga. And in all these ways, in all these festivals, we actually celebrate the presence of the erotic, gorgeous, utterly pure, sparkling, radiant presence of Shakti, the divine feminine, in her myriad auspicious forms, as she performs one of her profound functions inside the human and natural world, which is the function of restoring light after periods of darkness. And, of course, we constantly need to have light restored, because every single time we have a negative or despairing thought or a difficult encounter, we enter some form of darkness. And in the non-dual tradition of goddess, the dark qualities in life are no less divine than the light ones. Nonetheless, in our lives, in our practice, in our process, in our family, not only do we prefer the light, but we also celebrate it whenever we experience it. And one of the reasons that we prefer the light is because at our heart, at our very core, we are light. So even as we hold the recognition that this light that we are is the creative source of everything that is, including those parts of life that feel filled with suffering and apparent darkness, nonetheless, when we come close to that light that's at our heart, there's a deep sense of pleasure, of joy, and of recognition of our own radiance. And that's what Diwali is all about. So let's start by taking a strong posture. And if you're seated, you can feel the connection of your sits bones with the seat. If you're driving, if you're listening to this in the car, of course, you probably want to keep your eyes open and your attention on the road. But nonetheless, you can give some part of your attention to this practice that we're going to do now. So have the feeling that as you sit, as the sits bones deepen and become heavy and sink into the earth, as the spinal column elongates upward through the crown, have the feeling at this moment that the crown of your head opens. And as you inhale, you feel that you're inhaling particles of the light force of the goddess, who is literally at all times, but especially at times like this, literally pouring blessing in the form of particles of golden light, solar light, in from the unspeakable vastness of the subtle realms into our bodies. And you can allow yourself to breathe in this light. And as the light flows in, see if you can allow it to pool as golden radiance in the center of your chest, in the region of the inner heart. So the inhalation is bringing these particles of golden solar light into the heart, and with the exhalation, you feel that light spreading through the whole chest region, rising up through the head and flowing down through the belly. Not in any way trying to guide the light, just having the feeling that with the exhalation, the light expands, and with the inhalation, the light flows into your body. And in this moment, as we begin to bring that light into the body and subsequently, consequently, into the mind, have the feeling also that the light flows in with an intention. And that intention is the intention to awaken you, to open you, to bring you into a deeper connection with your own core of light, with your own vast heart, with your own love. And we're going to continue now by chanting the invocational mantras that call on the goddess Lalita. And then we'll chant the full Bij invocation to the goddess. So if you have the chanting sheets that are on the website, on the course page of the website, you can chant along. Otherwise, listen. And I'll begin by telling you the meaning of the verses, which the verses that we're going to be chanting are called a dhyana shloka, that is, a mantra that gives a meditative way to contemplate the goddess. And this particular verse calls on her form, saying she is extremely entrancing, with a bow and arrows in her hand, and beautiful beyond measure. She is abundant with rosy radiance, compassion, and youthfulness. We praise the beauty of the universe with which she manifests and in which, within which she resides. And the verse goes on to say, O goddess, you are the protector of the most secret of mystical secrets. Please accept the mantras that I offer and grant me the attainment of self-realization. Atimadura chapahastam aparimita morabana saubhagyam aruna matisaya karunam abhinavakula sundarim one day. Om Guyati Guya Goptritvam Grihanas Matkritam Japam Siddhir Bhavatu Me Devi Twat Prasadan Maheshwari. And then these mantras, many of you know them. They are also on the chanting sheet. We're going to chant them 9 times. And I'll chant first, and you can chant along with me once you catch on. And if you know them already, we'll chant together from the beginning. So the words of the chant are Om, the primordial mantra of the manifest universe flowing out of the infinite. Ayim, which is the mantra which stands for beginnings, for inspiration, for all forms of creativity, and specifically for the goddess Saraswati. The third word is Hrim. Hrim is the full expression of goddess as the creator of universes. Shrim is the fourth syllable. It means auspiciousness itself. It's a mantra for goddess Lakshmi. And it's also the mantra which expresses the truth that Shakti, the supreme reality, is always filled with beauty and abundance. And having offered these mantras which describe aspects of her being, inspiration, the capacity for manifesting everything, and pure auspiciousness, we invoke her under the name Lalita Ambikaye. Lalita meaning the playful one. Ambika means the lotus-eyed mother. So Lalita Ambikaye is the playful lotus-eyed mother, and the particular meaning of the name Ambika indicates that we're referring to the great goddess, the Mahashakti, the primordial feminine. So in other words, Lalita Ambikaye is not just any goddess. She's not just a consort goddess, even though she is married to Shiva in the mythology. She is the primordial creatrix, sustainer, destroyer of the universes. She's the one who hides within the world and who ultimately gives us the grace to realize that we ourselves are full expressions of her light. So we'll chant 9 times, and this will be our invocational mantra throughout the class. If you've come out of your posture, you can come back into it. And specifically, I'm going to suggest that you let your attention continue to flow from above the crown into the heart. So as though you're breathing in the sound of the mantras along with the light of the higher realms into the crown, and then allowing it to pool, to become a lake inside your heart. Om Aim Rim Shrim Lalita Ambikaye Namaha. 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 One more time. Om Aim Rim Shrim Lalita Ambikaye Namaha. And just for a moment, see if you can allow the breath to flow in through the crown with Om Aim Hrim Shrim. And then with the exhalation, see if you can allow the energy within the syllables to flow silently through your body. Om Aim Hrim Shrim flowing from above the crown into the heart with the inhalation, and then flowing as pure energy through the body with the exhalation. There's a question that comes up for just about everybody, not only on the spiritual journey, but in most lives. And the question is, how do I fall in love with my life? If you're a spiritual person, then the question is, how do I find the sacredness in my life, especially given the tumultuous and difficult nature of our world right now? My experience is that it's goddess practice, non-dual goddess practice, that lets us answer this. So just a couple of things. I know that many of you here have studied goddesses with me and in other situations, so this may not be new to you, but since it's a sacred truth, it's very much worth paying attention to, especially because every time we hear these truths, we hear them from a different place and in a different way. So goddess practice is a spiritual technology that lets you pierce through the density of your experience of the physical world so that you can begin to experience the energy inside it, and especially to recognize that that energy is inherently blissful, inherently ecstatic. Goddess practice opens neural pathways. It literally does. It literally opens neural pathways that allow us to reframe our experience so that we actually begin to feel a kind of subtle, erotic connectedness with every element of life. So the kiss of the goddess of bliss is an inner initiation that will eventually let you experience your body, your mind, and the world with a kind of ecstatic mindfulness, a kind of ecstatic reverence. And this is what Goddess Lalita opens in us. These are the neural pathways that govern mystical pleasure, the experience of being embraced, the capacity for true expansion, an expansion of consciousness that doesn't leave you feeling discombobulated and ungrounded, but which actually connects you even more deeply to the physical world. One of my favorite contemporary writers says that divine feminine practice is about reconstructing a part of ourselves that we often let go of so long ago that we don't always even know it's there. That presence is inherently blissful, even when the circumstances of our life are painful. And as many of you know, one of the paradoxes of reality is that ecstasy, that experience of blissfulness can actually come on very strongly, even in the midst of very great pain. And when we connect to it, our actions come from the center of bliss in a way that lets you experience a kind of, far more than contentment or equanimity, a kind of joyful wonder at the twists of the journey. So I call this vision that began to be apparent to me many years ago, and similarly to many of you, I call this a path to a feminine style of enlightenment. I call it feminine not because it's only for women, and it's certainly many of the greatest male practitioners for thousands of years have followed this path, but because at its core, there's a realization that the world and your own physical and emotional bodies are inundated, soaked in a love-saturated energy that, as we get to know it, actually feels intrinsically feminine. We call it feminine, by the way, one of the reasons I like to call it feminine. It's because it's really very different than the traditional enlightenment paths, which have, again, traditionally mainly been practiced by very, very carefully selected male practitioners. And these are paths which have asked us to detach ourselves from our bodies and our sexuality and other worldly drives in order to pursue a transcendent freedom from entanglement with the world. Feminine practice, on the other hand, is based on the recognition that every particle of our physical and subtle bodies is saturated with the divine. And one of the ways, there are many aspects to divine feminine practice, some of which are classically receptive in the way that we've come to believe that the feminine is receptive, some of which are extremely active and even aggressive in ways that we have not always associated with the feminine. And this is why goddess practice is so incredibly rich and why so many people who practice it have discovered that goddess practice is one of the most effective ways there is to bring to light your own hidden powers. Because in the tantric tradition, goddess is power. I was having a conversation last weekend I was at a conference, this Science and Non-Duality conference, actually, where there are a lot of the people who come there to teach. There are many physicists and biologists and chemists who teach there, but many of the spiritual teachers are practitioners of direct path spirituality, as it's sometimes called, where you meditate on your own awareness, your own consciousness, as the so-called direct path into states of higher awareness. So this person I was talking to was saying that she was about to appear on a panel on the masculine, feminine, different forms of masculine and feminine practice, and she said, what we're talking about, there's a Taoist on the panel. We're going to talk about Yin practice and Yang practice, and I said, well, you know, in the Hindu tantras, masculine and feminine, the qualities of masculine and feminine are actually the opposite of the way the yin and yang paradigm describes them. In other words, in the tantric traditions, the masculine principle, Shiva, is silent, is still, is the yin principle, is the ground, whereas the feminine principle, Shakti, is the active power principle. And she was blown away by that. For some reason, she didn't know it. And like everyone I know who's been privy to that secret, who's discovered Tantra and that interesting reversal of what it means to be transcendently feminine and transcendently masculine, it offers huge insight, this understanding that the feminine, the Shakti, is power. So as I said, goddess practice, the practice of the sacred feminine in the tantric traditions, is very often undertaken for the sake of drawing in that power. And I'm telling you this because you're going to find that that's the case, if you haven't already, as you practice with the goddess Lalita Tripura Sundari, because she is considered to be at the absolute apex of the divine feminine hierarchy of consciousness, and to contain within herself every form of power, as we'll see when we talk about the myth associated with her. And I also want to say that one of the most important aspects of goddess practice is simply the fact that it can be undertaken on so many different levels. So we are going to be, especially tonight, we're going to be talking about the personal form, the iconographic, humanoid, anthropomorphic form of the goddess Lalita. But we're also going to be, tonight and throughout the course, we're going to be approaching goddess and invoking goddess in her many energetic forms as the Shakti within the breath, as the witness who sees us through every particle of the universe, as the power in mantra, in sound. So in this way, in goddess practice, we bring together all of our capacities, our capacity for imaginative recreation of the form, our capacity for discovering the subtle vibrations in sound, the power of breath, and the discernment that allows us to recognize the different energies in our body and in the world, and also to recognize their intrinsic divinity. Another thing that I want to say at the outset before we go more deeply into Lalita itself, Lalita herself, is to say something about the, let's call it the emotional style, or another way of saying it is the secret sauce that allows us to self-empower while doing goddess practice. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says that in the spiritual journey, it's so much easier to tune into a manifest, that is to say, an anthropomorphic form that represents the sacred, rather than trying to meditate directly on the formless. And, of course, that insight has been at the heart of all the devotional mystical traditions, and most of the mystical traditions in, you know, throughout the world have been essentially devotional traditions. So Hinduism, Christianity, Sufism, Tibetan Buddhism, all of these traditions make a place for devotional practice, make a place for tuning into form as a way into the formless. What makes these forms genuinely powerful and transformative actually is the feeling states that we're able to bring to them, and also the feeling states that they give us access to. So, and these, the feeling state that goddess practice, that deity practice can kindle in us, then becomes a resource that we can bring ourselves into over and over again in the course of our lives when we want to enter an empowered state or a state of realization or recognition of our higher self. So, and the paradox here is that throughout mystical literature, what of whatever tradition, we're told that the secret of effective practice is to tune in to an empowered feeling state. And this skill of tuning into feeling states in your practice is what's called devotion, or in Sanskrit, bhakti. And although there are many, many different meanings of the word devotion, and often we believe that devotion means falling in love. But what devotion actually means is being able to kindle an affective, that is, an emotional connection to our practice. And interestingly enough, this same principle is one of the hallmarks of the so-called New Thought practice, that is, of the law of attraction. And so much of the formulas in the American self-help traditions. So in the New Thought tradition, they don't use the word devotion. They generally speaking use the word feeling or emotional connection. What that is your willingness to care about what you're doing. Not in an anxious way, you know, not because you're trying to make something work or because you're afraid something is not going to work, or not because you should, not because it's a duty, but because the prospect of getting connected to this juicy quality that you find in the form or in the mantra or in the meditation practice or in the asana, the rasa, as it's said in Sanskrit, the flavor, the feeling, because that feeling is attractive to you. It gives you pleasure. So the real secret of, let's call it, success in spiritual practice, no matter what it is pleasure. You know, it's the desire and the feeling that you can enjoy what you're doing. So, and that experience of enjoyment in its highest state, in its most intense state, is called passion. And this quality of passion, of passionate, erotic connection, is the inner felt sense of Shakti. Another name for this feeling is arousal, charge. The more we're aroused, the more Shakti a practice has, and the more power it has to transform us. So essentially, in spiritual practice, we're following a fundamental principle, which is that wherever there is intensity, wherever there is charge, wherever there is feeling, even if it's just a feeling of mild interest, that is the breadcrumb trail of the Shakti. And one of the reasons why Lalita Tripura Sundari is such a significant goddess is because she really does hold this capacity to arouse intensity in us. So another sort of general point that I'd like to make here as we enter this sequence, this series, is to look at what we mean when we talk about deity practice, about the form of deity practice. You know, in contemporary culture, especially the culture that was, you know, that has taken shape since the early 20th century discoveries of Carl Jung and others of his school, one of the great contributions that Jung and Rudolf Steiner and others other great 20th century subtle thinkers revealed to us is that symbols, pictures, stories, the basis of mythology and all of the icons and symbols of religious thought, that these things, you know, these subtle symbols, pictures, stories, actually serve as mediators between the subtle realms that are not immediately apparent to the mind and our human consciousness. In other words, to tell you God is in everything does not necessarily kindle a felt sense of the divine in everything. But, for instance, if you see a painting like the Alex Gray painting, which shows a landscape with hundreds and hundreds of eyes in it, hundreds and hundreds of open eyes, it conveys to you the feeling that consciousness exists in the physical world. You know, and that's one of the ways in which a symbol is powerful. The forms of deities, the forms of goddesses, function that way, function symbolically. And what they especially do for us as symbols, as focal points in our practice, what they especially do for us is open us to the powers that we hold inside, the powers that we may not be consciously aware of, and also the deeper longings and desires which may have been covered over by not only our conditioning, but our ideas about who and what we should be as humans. Throughout this class, throughout these weeks, going to be meditating on the anthropomorphic form of the goddess. We're, of course, going to be meditating on her mantras, and we're also going to be practicing with geometric visual forms, including the Sri Yantra, which we'll begin to talk about next week, and some of the very, very esoteric messages that are contained in that yantra. So, let's close our eyes. Find your posture. And we're going to practice with one of the most immediate experiences of how the Goddess of Bliss enters our body. Sitting with your eyes closed, just have the recognition for a moment that the air around you, the universe around you, is touching your body through the skin. Every part of your body is touched by the air. And begin to allow the breath to flow in and out very naturally, entering and leaving your body through the nostrils. See if you can feel the sensuality of the air sliding in through your nostrils, swishing through the nasal passages, flowing down into the lungs. Consider how the breath is a gift of grace, coming into your body freely without any effort. This is such a natural and normal experience to be breathed. Now consider that your breathing is part of the breath force that moves the planet. Every living thing is being entered and enlivened by the breath, by the prana shakti. Even the earth, we're told, breathes. The earth has this very subtle rhythm of expanding and contraction. which we can call respiration. So every one of us, inside and out, is being embraced, touched, opened, brought to life by the air around us. And though we're mostly unconscious of it, unless we're standing under a wind or under a fan, we mostly ignore the air. And unless we're having a hard time breathing, we pretty much ignore the breath. And yet, air and spirit in many of the ancient traditions were the same word. Breath and spirit were the same word. The inner self, Atman in Sanskrit, was originally called by the same name as breath or wind. Psyche, the Greek word for consciousness, originally meant air. The ancients believed that we're given life moment to moment by the force of air. And the thing about air, which we are, again, not always conscious of, is that it operates through touch. It operates through caress. It operates sensually. In the Indian tradition, the medium through which touch happens is the medium of air, the medium of breath. So we interact with the physical world through touch, through the subtle touch of the breath. We are in relationship to everything around us through the touch of the air. So see if you can have the recognition that the air around you, the universe around you, wants to love you open. See if you can let yourself become completely receptive to the loving caress of the universe flowing through the breath. Touching your body through the skin. Can you let the breath caress you open? Can you let yourself be loved open by the goddess Lalita, flowing as the prana shakti that enlivens your body?
Thank you.
Now, when you open your eyes, see if you can open them holding on to this recognition that the goddess is making love to you through the air. And what that means is that all the objects that you see with your eyes open are also part of this lovemaking. Your contact with the furniture in the room or with your physical body, if you look at it, is a sensual, literally sensory, sensual contact with the goddess who has become your body, the natural world, and even the mechanical, human-constructed world. So let's talk for a moment. We've just invoked the omnipresent quality of Goddess Lalita as the prana, the life force in the universe. And now let's invoke her for a moment through a mythological story. The story of Lalita is inextricably twined with the erotic quality of life itself. The story of Lalita starts with a very famous moment in the life of the universe, which is the moment when Shiva destroys the god of lust, whose name is Kama, and we'll speak about him in a moment. Those of you who are familiar with this story, which is one of the most famous stories in Indian mythology, the story goes that the gods, the major deities, Brahma and Vishnu, the deities of creation and sustenance in the world, have gotten upset because Shiva is so indrawn, he's completely lost in meditation. And so they decide that they will tempt him out of his meditation, of course, in the time-honored fashion, by exciting his interest in a woman. So they persuade the goddess, because, of course, Shiva can't be enticed by anyone who's not his equal. They entice the goddess, Shakti, to take a form and to get to know Shiva and get him romantically interested in her. So she takes birth as the goddess Parvati and begins to sit with Shiva in his mountain retreat. And one day when Brahma and Vishnu feel the time has come, they send the god Kama, the Indian Cupid, the Indian deity of lust, essentially, to come into the grove and shoot Shiva with one of his intoxicating arrows, Kama's arrows, which, interestingly enough, are also the arrows of the goddess Lalita. We'll get into that later. Kama's arrows have names like the intoxicator, the inflamer, the essence of lustfulness. So he sends all these arrows into Shiva's heart, and Shiva is filled with a stirring of emotion, and he opens his eyes. He sees this beautiful girl sitting in front of him, the goddess Parvati, who is his eternal consort, as it happens. And he's infuriated that somehow something has incited this feeling of physical attraction towards a woman. He looks around to see how this happened. He sees the god Kama hiding behind a tree. He opens his third eye and incinerates Kama. So the god of lust falls into a pile of ashes at his feet. And now this is a very complicated act that Shiva has done. And it happens to be actually an activity that's really one of the most central acts of what I would call ascensionist or transcendent-focused spirituality. In other words, that the understanding behind this is that in order to make spiritual progress, in order to meditate, you have to destroy not only physical lust, but also the feelings of romantic love, attraction, any form of emotion that might draw you into communication with another person. It's a very, very rigorous and difficult austerity to undertake, the austerity of destroying emotion, destroying lust, destroying eros. So Kama is now a pile of ashes, and one of Shiva's attendants, one of his ganas, that's the name for Shiva's attendants, they're sort of goblins, starts playing around with Kama's ashes and thinks, wouldn't it be great to sort of make a little human form out of this pile of ashes? So he ends up creating an image of a man. And then he prays to Shiva, who he's very close to enliven this man. And lo and behold, the image comes alive. And then the image takes on the form of a full-grown human. And this human, this being, who actually has he actually is an incarnate form of unprocessed lust. In other words, he's pure lust without any sense of higher purpose, value, affection, any of the other qualities that are normally mixed with our sexual desires. And therefore, he has the form, the quality of a demon. So Shiva, who's watching this whole process, is kind of amazed that his associate has been able to create this form. And so he says, he praises it. He says, bund, which means in the early Sanskritic language that Shiva was speaking at that time, means good. And once he's praised this figure, the figure of Bund, the demon Bund, then feels empowered to ask Shiva for a boon. He says, please allow me to rule the world for 60,000 years. I mean, God knows why Shiva says yes to this, but it's just the conditions in which the story can occur. And, you know, if you want to look at this story from a symbological point of view, that this demonic emanation of Bunda actually personifies what happens when erotic energy is repressed, especially through ascetic denial. That, you know, the energy of desire is naturally transformative. It can be sublimated and used for fueling higher consciousness. And it, you know, if that, when that happens, it fuels spiritual unfoldment. However, simply repressing desire can give rise to all sorts of negative emotions like irritability, rage. You know, the Western and Eastern mythologies are filled with stories of ascetics, yogis, whose sexual repression turns into anger that is taken out on anyone who crosses them. So this demon has taken form out of Shiva's repressed erotic desire, and he then begins to do what demons do in all these stories and enslave everyone in the world. So at this point, the gods again call on the goddess. And this is where it sometimes gets confusing to a Western mind, because when the gods call on the goddess, that is to say, on the primordial Shakti, she takes form as the goddess Lalita, who is, in fact, another form of Parvati. So, and this is a very important thing to understand, Lalita is a form of Parvati who is fully empowered to be not only a consort of her beloved Shiva, but also an independent power who acts in her own right. So Lalita, both in the myth and in the ways that she's generally invoked and honored in the tradition, represents a very pure form of feminine empowerment. She's, I would say, in our time, the figure of the goddess Lalita, who is both a love goddess, that is, a goddess who's connected to a beloved masculine form, and also a goddess who is dependent on nothing and no one for her power. So Lalita takes a form which we'll describe later. We're going to meditate on her in a moment. She enters into an epic battle with the demon Bunda, and this is the way the story is told. Bunda, as it turns out, holds within himself all of the demonic forces that are described throughout Indian mythology. And if you know Indian mythology, you know some of them. Ravana, the demon of the Ramayana, Shumba and Nishumba, whom you may know from the Durga myths, all of these demonic forces are held in the form of Bunda, the demon. In Lalita's form are all the avatars of the gods. In other words, Rama, Krishna, the various forms of the goddess, the 10 avatars of Vishnu, they're all held in the body of the goddess. And so the divine forms within Lalita's body and the demonic forms within Bunda's body have an epic battle in which, of course, the goddess wins. And after she has polished off Bunda, the avatar of demonic lustfulness, she restores the body of Kama, the god of desire. And as she does this, Lalita brings desire, the empowering aspect of human desire and passion, into the light. And we could say she creates in this moment the incredibly sophisticated path of Tantra, in which desire, instead of being a force that has to be conquered in order for us to know the inner self, is recognized as actually the most powerful force there is in allowing us to know the self. So Lalita, in many of the traditions, is given the name Kameshwari, which means the Lady of Desire. She has many other names, among them names like the Ocean of Compassion, the Eternal Witness of All. But in the hymns that celebrate her, her capacity to incarnate desire in all its forms, desire as erotic desire, desire as romantic desire, and also desire as spiritual longing, become really paramount in our understanding of how the divine feminine works. One of the, you know, the great recognitions that contemporary biology has given us is the understanding that, in a certain sense, this entire universe is built on desire. Brian Swim, in his wonderful book, The Universe is a Green Dragon, describes how one of the factors in the biochemistry of the universe he calls this the quality of allurement, this quality that draws quarks and atoms and molecules together to become more complex cells and then multicellular life forms, and that throughout the experience of life, there is this constant movement of attraction that brings things together, and there's also, of course, a movement of repulsion that draws them apart, which is known in science and in cosmology as entropy. But it's desire that brings forth the ecological panoply of life in this universe. Even in the plant world, we see that desire and intention are manifested in these living beings who don't have the mobility that humans and animals have, but who have the capacity to attract what they need, to attract desire from bees and butterflies that allow them to propagate and even to draw the awareness of their needs from their human caretakers. If you've ever had a plant that felt to you like it was screaming for water, you know what I mean. The plant kingdom can communicate what it wants and needs very loudly because desire is such a powerful force. So the goddess Lalita stands for this quality of desire. She's Kameshwari. And as Kameshwari, she is not only the goddess of sexual desire, she's also the goddess of this, the highest forms of desire, which in traditional spiritual practice draw the inner energy of Kundalini from her sleeping form, draws her up the chakras to unite with the highest principle in the Sahasrara. So she is desire, that the desire which creates new life through bodies, and she's the desire which draws the soul into communion with itself. To deeply understand the nature of Lalita, I'd like to just take a couple of minutes to draw our attention back to the way in which the tantras describe reality, the absolute non-duality with which the tantras describe reality. And as I describe this, I'm going to ask you to focus on the breath and to allow this same sensation of drawing in the goddess from the higher realms in through your crown and into the heart with the inhalation. And then with the exhalation, allowing yourself to relax into the heart with the feeling that this light of goddess is flowing through your body. So one of the ways in which the absolute reality is described in Tantra, is as prakasha and vimarsha. Prakasha means light. It describes the fact that at its core, reality is light. Pure radiance, pure effulgence, the light brighter than a thousand suns that we read about in the Bhagavad Gita and other texts. Its other aspect, vimarsha, as it's called, is the capacity of reality to know itself, to see itself, to experience itself, to reflect on itself. And this is a very important aspect of the tantric understanding. The prakasha aspect is connected to Shiva, the divine masculine, which, of course, at this level has nothing to do with gender. It's simply a way of describing the binary nature of reality, which is both the quality of absolutely unmoved radiance, a radiance that cannot be broken, which is utterly still, which is at the heart of everything. The vimarsha aspect is that quality in the light which constantly turns back onto itself, recognizes itself, recognizes its existence, and falls in love with itself over and over and over again. So reality as light and the capacity for to experience that light is what we mean by Shiva and Shakti. And the thing is about that self-recognizing ability within the light. That self-awareness, that capacity to feel its own existence and love, to self-reflect, is the aspect of divine reality that is able to experience aliveness, ecstasy, and power. So at the heart of this aspect of reality, the vimarsha aspect of reality, which is also known as Shakti, are contained the powers to desire, to know, and to act. The three great powers which express themselves as this universe. So the power of desire, which is one of the words for desire is kama, as we have seen, which has a sexual connotation. But it also means love. It's also a synonym for the active aspect of blissfulness. And it's also called will, the power of will in Sanskrit. Icha Shakti is the power of desire. And the story is that as this great light reflects back on itself, recognizes itself, enjoys itself, something happens within it, a kind of arousal, and that word arousal is very important in this whole process. A kind of arousal occurs, a leaping forth. It said, Shakti, leaping forth in bliss. Shakti, leaping forth in bliss, conceives of creating a universe. And because in the tantras, and again, this is the crucial idea in the tantras, because in the tantras, the basic understanding is that the great Shiva Shakti awareness, love, that we call God or transcendent awareness, is also fully present as our own mind, body, and heart. So this experience of our natural consciousness reflecting back on itself, and from that self-reflection, beginning the process of creating worlds, is experienced by us moment by moment by moment. And the example that the text gives is that the experience of waking up from sleep or coming out of deep meditation. So if you remember what it's like to wake up, and I'm going to suggest that you try this tomorrow, you know, when you start to wake up, the first moment of awakening, there's no sense of being a particular person. There's just a pure experience of being, pure experience of existing. And then what you'll notice as you pay attention is that differentiation starts to arise. And in most of us, it's a kind of impulse to find out where I am, who I am, and eventually to open my eyes. So out of the experience of being comes an impulse, a stir, which will eventually lead to opening your eyes, getting into your day. That experience, that desire, separates your consciousness from your sense of being. That experience of desire, that impulse, separates your consciousness from your sense of being. So before, there was just being with consciousness immersed in it, consciousness inseparable from it. But once there begins to be a stir of desire, there's a separation. A part of you is simply existing. Another part of you is aware of existing. And in that awareness of existing, wants to do something. So that first impulse of wanting, that first impulse of desiring, is the seed of everything that comes. And it's one of the reasons why desire and will and intention are such a crucial part of anything that we want to bring forth into the world. The Rig Veda says about the creation of the universe that moved first as desire within itself. Desire was the primal seed of mind. So desire gives rise to thought, or as the Rig Veda says, mind. It creates something. Thought is a something. And it then seeds itself as to into everything that is born in the great mind of the Absolute, in the primordial imagination. Because at the heart of tantric understanding is that everything that arises, everything that we experience as a universe, is actually arising as thoughts in the imagination, as images in the cosmic imagination. And the corollary of this, which is probably the most important and most radical recognition that any of us can have, the corollary of this is that our own imagination, our own capacity for recognizing our own being and self-consciously creating thought forms within our own being, within our own mind, this creative capacity in the human imagination is not different from the divine imagination. In other words, this is a completely non-dual universe. There's one mind in this universe which is manifesting through thought and action. whether it's manifesting in the absolute mind, which is capable of creating a big bang, which then gives rise to countless physical universes. That's one form of creation. Another form of creation, which I would say my entire sadhana, my 45 years of sadhana, has been an attempt to unpack this recognition in my own experience. And that is also true of your sadhana, whether you know it or not. All we're doing here is opening ourselves to the recognition that the divine imagination, which is the underpinning of this physical universe, is also our imagination. Even though, yes, we're the microcosm, and that is the macrocosm, nonetheless, the human imagination contains all the powers that are in the great mind, including the power to recognize its own divine nature. So that desire arising within the cosmic mind is the primordial Shakti Lalita. Lalita has three names. She's called Lalita, which means the playful one. She's called Tripura Sundari, which means, I'm going to explain this in a minute. It's a name that has a lot of esoteric significance. Sundari means beautiful. Tripura means, it literally means the three cities. What the three cities refers to is a very important truth of the tantras, which we also see in other traditions, which is that the universe is formed in sets of three. So the three cities are the three activities of creation, sustenance, and dissolution, which are at the heart of all the processes in nature. It also stands for the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state, which are the states that human beings go through in life. It stands for past, present, and future. It stands for the three great spiritual centers, the Muladhara, the heart, and the Sahasrara. And of course, in Christian practice, it stands for the Trinity of, well, they call it Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Let's call it Parent, Child, and Holy Spirit. So Lalita is the beautiful one who is the essence of all these triplicities, which together make up all that is. Lalita, who embodies cosmic desire, embodies it in two forms. One of her desires is to expand herself to become the great work of art that is this universe, the great movie, the great magic show that becomes this universe. And her second desire is to gather the universe back into herself. So that desire within the universe that desire of the Shakti to express herself as the universe, and the desire of the Shakti to draw the universe back into herself, first of all, implies that there is no difference between the primordial Shakti, the goddess, and the universe. And it also tells us something else. Because the intrinsic nature of Shakti is blissfulness, another name for it is love, another name for it is kama, desire. because the intrinsic nature of Shakti is blissfulness. Blissfulness exists in every particle of this universe and in every particle of our mind, though obviously we're not always aware of that. And that loving, that desiring, that blissfulness will ultimately be revealed to us as the goddess draws us back into herself. And the act of drawing us back into herself from the point of view of you and I is the experience that we call grace. It's the experience of being able to recognize our own beauty, our own lovingness, our own profound connectedness. This is Lalita drawing us back into herself because she herself is the essence of love and connectedness. And again, one of the primal teachings of the Tantras is that because everything that exists is a part of her and is literally run by her, in other words, has no independent existence outside of her, we need her decision to open us to the truth of what we are. And that's the reason that sages have worshipped Shakti. It's out of the recognition that she is everything that we are and everything that exists. And at the same time, she has concealed the fact that she is all this. And if we are going to know what we are, we need her to lift the veil. That's all it is. We need her to lift the veil. Aurobindo, the great 20th century sage, says, "Love exists by itself, and its movements are free and independent of the objects through which it manifests." So love exists by itself. Shakti exists by herself. Her movements are free and independent of everything through which she manifests. Aurobindo goes on to say, love is everywhere. Love exists in plants as well as in animals, perhaps even in rocks. So love, desire, Eros is one of the doorways through which we can tune into the presence of Goddess. Love itself, which manifests in thousands of ways, it manifests as erotic sentiment, it manifests as intellectual engagement, it manifests as interest in our life. It manifests as attractions. It manifests in thousands and thousands of ways and with thousands and thousands of objects. The truth is, we can love anything, and we don't always know why we love what we love. But the love we experience in whatever form is an individuation of divine love. And even though in human life love might bring the suffering of attachment, of jealousy, of anger, these are simply flavors of the primal love, which is actually our aliveness itself. And what Tantra says is that we can use even the negative flavors of love as a way back to the divine. Because even when our experience of it is partial and limited, it's still a doorway into the divine love, into Lalita. So Lalita's deepest message is that any spark of love we feel or even think about is an instant connection to her, because love, eros, passion, and beauty are Lalita's main forms within us. So it's for this reason that in tantric practice, there's so much attention to the personal form. Because what we are able to do through meditation on an imaginary form, imagined form, a form that we can create through our imagination, such a form, because it's a form that's not of purely human origin, it's, you know, when we use our imagination to create sacred forms, what we're actually doing is mining our imaginative consciousness for the archetype that exists at its core. In other words, the goddess Lalita, whom we experience in our own consciousness through a picture or through creating an image, an internal image. That goddess who lives in every particle of the universe, including in your own mind, that goddess comes alive for you through your visualization, through your mantra, because when you decide to visualize her or to repeat one of the names of her, you are signaling to your consciousness that you are ready to become intimate with the deepest depths of yourself. So in other words, by entering into the practice of visualizing goddess or chanting a hymn to the goddess, or repeating the mantra of a goddess, or breathing with the sense that you're being breathed by the goddess, you are signaling your consciousness to release the veils that keep you from seeing that she is all that you are. So let's take a deep breath. Inhale, exhale. And allow your body to move into a meditative posture. And this is going to be our longest meditation of the night, and it's going to be a visual meditation of the goddess Lalita. So feel the connection between the base of your body and the seat. And allow your body to take the support of the seat. Inhale, and as you inhale, see if you can let your attention come down to the base of the posture, deepen your connection to the seat through the inhalation, and then with the exhalation, feel that the breath elongates your spinal column up through the crown of the head. Bring your awareness to the breath process and see if you can once again begin to feel that the inhalation is caressing your inner body through the nostrils, through the nasal passages, down into your lungs. Have the feeling that you're being seen by an invisible presence who hovers in the air. She's in front of you, she's behind you, she's present on all sides. Her intention is to embrace you with her love. She's gazing at you through every particle of the air with a gaze that is not only benign, it's totally ecstatic. To get a sense of how Lalita sees you, imagine a time or remember a time when you felt most alive, most in your power, most beautiful, most creative. For many of us, for most of us, there's an image of such a moment. Perhaps the most recent, perhaps a long ago one. Just find that moment when you felt completely alive and in love. Now double that. See if you can heighten that feeling. Triple it. Can you imagine that feeling of aliveness 10 or 20 or 50 times more powerful and ecstatic? This is the feeling state of the goddess Lalita, who is showering that state on you through the air with her gaze. Feel now that this power of radical aliveness and ecstasy coalesces into a feminine form. And you see that form now sitting in front of you as though floating in the air. I want to say that I'm going to describe her, and for some of you, the description may bring her immediately into a sense of visual presence. You don't have to actually visualize her to experience her presence. It's enough to allow the description to kindle a feeling, to kindle a sense of intimation of the goddess's presence. The sense that as we talk about her and feel into her, a vortex is being kindled that you are going to be able to open to and to experience. The form of the goddess Lalita is slender and youthful. This is the body that she takes on to allure you through the beauty of her form. What we must understand about the goddess is that she can take any form. So the form she is taking to appear to you is the one that you find most beautiful. She is red. Her body is red. Not the bright scarlet that you might imagine, but the color of a bright rosy sunset. So it's a translucent color. It's the color of rosy light because her body is made of light. There's a quality to her of having flushed, being flushed with excitement, with ecstasy. And in all the descriptions of how Lalita looks, she's said to be flush with the aftermath of ecstatic lovemaking. So she's filled with eros, with love. I'm going to describe her face the way I experience her, and the way the poems about her describe her. She has large, lustrous, compelling eyes, which are very wide. They're almond-shaped, or as the texts say, they're the shape of lotus petals. In the center of her forehead is a vertical third eye, which is open, indicating that she's completely awake to her real nature and the nature of the world. Around her neck is a necklace of skulls. And the necklace of skulls, like everything about the appearance of the goddess, and as I describe them, you might just imagine, perhaps from pictures you've seen, what a necklace of skulls might look like on this, the beautiful neck of the goddess. The skulls represent the different voices of ego, all the different negative energies, but they also have a positive meaning. They represent the letters of the Sanskrit alphabet, which are known as matrikas, a word that means little mother. And the letters of the Sanskrit alphabet in the linguistic mysticism of Tantra are understood to represent the powers that manifest reality. They manifest reality through the vibrations that emanate out of the Big Bang. They also manifest reality through the thoughts that we hold in the mind, something that we're going to talk about later on in the class. So the fact that she's wearing the garland of skulls means that she is a master of language. Language which can both bind us in concepts, which is when we are considered to be pashus or bound souls. And it can also enlighten us through great teachings, through mantras, and through intuition, through our inner understanding. So Lalita is the mistress of both kinds of language. Now, in the iconography, Lalita sits on a bed that comes out of a lotus that grows out of the navel of her consort Shiva. So Shiva, who lies on the ground with his eyes closed as if in a swoon, is himself supported by four male gods. And these four male gods are acting like caryatids in Greek sculpture. They're like pillars upholding the bed on which Shiva lies. One of them is Brahma, the creator. Another is Vishnu, the sustainer. Another is Rudra, the destroyer. And the fourth is a form of Shiva known as Ishana, who contains the power to conceal the divinity within reality. And the iconography that shows the goddess being supported by these four male gods and floating on a lotus from the navel of her consort show that she is the supreme Shakti herself. She is the power that flows through all the processes of creation, sustenance, and destruction. She's the power that conceals the nature of reality. So this iconography is tremendously significant for us as a image, as a symbol of the nature of the universe. She has four hands, four arms and four hands. In one of her hands, she holds a bow made of sugar cane. In another, she holds five arrows made of flowers, very similar to Kama's flower arrows and his sugar cane bow. Her other two hands hold a noose, a lariat, a piece of rope, and an elephant goad, which is a very nasty looking metal hook. So here's what they mean. The bow represents the mind, and it also represents the power of desire and intention. Desire in Tantra is another name for intention. Desire is an empowered wish that is shot from the bow of the mind. The arrows which the mind uses to attain its ends are the senses, the sense of hearing, of sight, of taste, of smell, and of touch. And the senses flow towards sense objects. And here's the thing. In the tantric tradition, everything that we experience through the senses is actually being created in the moment that we experience. And this is the esoteric secret of the goddess Lalita. Her bow represents both the cosmic mind and cosmic desire, and our mind and our desire. The arrows represent the inner sense organs, which are constantly creating experience for us. The noose that she carries in her third hand is the binding power of desire, which, as we said earlier, draws everything in the world together and keeps us held. Every desire that we allow to take form in our mind, again, according to the tantras, will eventually create something that we are going to get to experience. And that's why Lalita has a noose, because it is our wishes, it is our desires that hold us in this life, in this wheel that the Indian texts call samsara. But the noose also stands for the binding power of love and the binding power of our longing. Because just as desire keeps us bound to the wheel of samsara, our longing for immersion in the self, in the divine, in the goddess, holds us to her. It keeps us focused on the essence, even while we're going through our lives, even while we're living out our karmas. So like every iconographic symbol in Tantra, the noose has a double meaning. And the goad, my favorite instrument, it's the goad that they use to drive elephants, and it works by literally pricking the skin. The goad represents all the different forms of suffering. The goad is our unfulfilled desires, our fear, the emotions like anger and jealousy, the pain of failure, the pain of loss. All of these are the emotions that prick us, that create our suffering, and which eventually draw us towards the goddess. So, and again, this is a fundamental tantric principle. Our suffering, our pain, if we can allow ourselves to fully become one with it, enter into it, is going to reveal itself as an aspect of the goddess. So the same mind which constantly distracts us with thoughts and desires also can open to reveal itself as ecstasy and as the underpinning of all that is, as goddess herself. The noose which keeps us bound to our attachments can reveal itself as the divine rope that keeps us one-pointed on our divine nature. The arrows of the senses can show us the really remarkable and blissful experience that everything we see and touch and taste and smell can give us divine ecstasy if we understand what it is. And the goad allows us to assimilate our suffering and use it as an instrument for connecting us to the truth. So, the goddess Lalita Tripura Sundari is seated in front of you, poised on the air. Her body undulates in and out of existence, evanescing like clouds of rosy red light. She has large, firm breasts, or perhaps they're small and dainty and delicate. You're Lalita. May have any hair color, any type of body, any face. But whatever her form, she is compellingly beautiful. Her eyes are filled with love. And she's looking at you with so much delight, as though the sight of you is the most beautiful thing she has ever seen. You become conscious of the fact that beams of golden light are flowing from her eyes into yours. With every breath, you allow yourself to drink in her gaze as it flows through your eyes, flows down through your brain, and begins to suffuse your mind with illumination, with positive, deeply intuitive insights about yourself. The insights that you are intrinsically adorable. You're just letting her golden eyes infuse you with the golden radiance of love. from her heart. A soft blue light is flowing into your heart. It's cooling in its radiance. And as you breathe in the blue light from Lalita's heart, you realize that it's cleansing your entire emotional body of wounds, of contractions. Of every form of limitation. Your inhalation draws the light into your heart. The exhalation sends it rippling through your body. And from the goddess's navel, you discern a ruby red light flowing into your navel. And with the inhalation, you feel it moving through your lower body, enlivening your torso, your belly, your hips and legs and feet, and the inner organs, the intestines, the genitals, the bladder, the colon, all filled with the rosy aliveness of Lalita's light. Let the breath open you more and more fully to intimacy with this goddess whose nature is light. The golden light flowing through your eyes, her eyes into yours, irradiating your brain with a golden, radiant clarity and ecstasy. The blue light of the heart purifying your emotional body of all its wounds, all of its contractions. The red light empowering your physical being with the rosy radiance of Lalita's erotic aliveness. These three lights, the gold, the blue, and the red, undulate through your body. As with every inhalation, you take her in, and with every exhalation, you let her fill you up. You're simply allowing yourself to receive the light of the goddess Lalita Tripura Sundari. She is the energy of your highest self. She is your life force. She is your love. Appearing through the grace of her divine imagination. To reveal to you that you embody that light as well. Let yourself breathe the goddess as light into your body. And then let yourself rest within yourself. Perhaps meditating on that light within yourself, or perhaps just resting in the felt sense that you are breathing and being breathed by Goddess. Might be a good moment to make a note or two about your experience this evening. For those of you who are on the live call, the recorded version will be available tomorrow, and Deb will let you know when. You'll also be receiving homework tomorrow. And you'll also be receiving an audio meditation based on the meditation that we just practiced. The listserv goes live tonight. And for those of you who have not practiced with these telesanghams, the listserv is a very beautiful way to communicate with each other, to ask questions. I will answer questions on the listserv. And we'll also have a live Q&A next week so that you can ask personally the questions that come up about the goddess and about your meditation. In next week's class, we will begin to discuss and meditate on the Sri Chakra and some of the mantras that are associated with it. Please know that what's been transmitted tonight is bigger than we might understand at this moment. And allow yourself to hold and contain the energy that's opened up in this call. I really would encourage you to sit for a few minutes at the end of the program and just let yourself feel the presence of the goddess, who is always already present, but who is especially present when we talk about her and contemplate her. This call is the beginning of a 21-day empowerment. So what we are doing here is creating a kind of retreat and a habit which you will experience more deeply as you make a commitment to practice the homework to invoke the goddess's presence. And to keep turning to the felt sense of Goddess Lalita Tripura Sundari as the presence that flows with the breath. As the Shakti who enlivens your mind, who allows you to see and hear and touch and taste through your senses. Who has become all the flavors of your emotional life, and who, once you commit yourself to recognizing her inside and around you, will also begin to transform the way you experience every piece of your life. Have an exquisite week. Start to recognize her presence in whatever arises, and recognize that her superpower is love. That the more you can invoke the presence of affection, of tenderness, of softness in meeting your experience, even when your experience feels hard and harsh and difficult, the more you can remember and invoke love, the more you bring Goddess online for yourself, and the more she will show you that love is what you're made of. Not Hallmark card kind of love, but the most energetic, empowered aliveness that we could ever imagine. Namaste, good night, happy Diwali, take care.